his gift to me, the Blessed Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am this morning a very grateful recovering alcoholic, and my name is Alexis.
Hi.
I'd like to first of all put in a plug for Wilma and Mac, just to let you know that these trouble during the day. There's a story told about an itinerant preacher down south, and it was his practice to roam through the little burgs in the southern part of our country. He'd arrive on Monday and he'd hang up all these signs announcing that on Saturday night there will be a revival. Everyone is welcome. He went down to Mississippi one time and he followed his regular procedure. He got there on Monday and he hung up his signs all over town, put up his tent, and on Saturday night when he went to the tent, there was only one farmer sitting there. And he looked at him and he said, "Well, brother," he said, "I guess no one's coming. It just isn't worth the trouble, so I guess we should call this thing off." Well, the old farmer said, "Reverend," he said, "I ain't one for advising the clergy, but," he said, "if I went down to the field to feed the cows," he said, "and there was only one cow there," he said, "I certainly would feed that one cow." The preacher said, "Brother, you're right. You're right." And so he proceeded to lay the message on him, you know, Genesis through Revelations, about 2.5 hours. Finally, he fell into the chair, exhausted. He said, "Well, brother," he said, "what do you think about that?" "Well," he said, "Reverend, like I say, I ain't one for advising the clergy," he said, "but if I went down to that field," he says, "and there was only one cow there, I wouldn't feed the whole damn carload." And so in a two-session workshop on spirituality, I sometimes feel like I'm trying to feed you the whole damn carload. You know? But again, I think the first thing to do this morning is to establish the background against which we are pursuing or investigating AA spirituality. We talked yesterday about those two conditions that should be present: a desire to be spiritual men and women, and a motivation to pursue it. And so we go first of all to the big book, and there we're reminded we are not cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Those are heavy words. Again, the big book says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us. Remember, the big book says, that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And Bill Wilson, in a letter written in 1966. The chief purpose of AA is sobriety. We all realize that without sobriety, we have nothing. However, it is possible to expand this simple aim into a great deal of nonsense, so far as the individual member is concerned. Sometimes we hear him say, in effect, sobriety is my sole responsibility. After all, I'm a pretty fine chap, except for my drinking. Give me sobriety, and I have it made. As long as our friend clings to this comfortable alibi, he will make so little progress with his real-life problems and responsibilities that he stands in fair way to get drunk again. This is why AA's 12 steps urge that we practice these principles in all our affairs. We are not living just to be sober. We are living to learn, to serve, and to love. I suggest that those quotations from the Big Book should excite us again in our desire and in our motivation for sobriety. There's so many papers up here, I don't know which end I'm at. I'd like to continue then what we started yesterday in some reflections upon the steps. The tenth step, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I found for myself personally, and that again is what I'm sharing with you, I'm not an expert on AA spirituality. I found for myself that it's very difficult to take a total inventory every day. To say, for example, I'm going to be good. Well, what does that mean? How can you examine yourself on that? When you go to bed at night, I fall asleep before I get halfway through that. Yeah. I think that maybe once a year, more often if it's possible, you know, at your anniversary, or maybe when you're making a retreat, or maybe at a time like this, that we look back on our total life. But to try and to do that every day seems to me to be overpowering. Also, we alcoholics are very easily given to discouragement. Very easily. We look at it and we say, I don't see any progress. You look at your fingernails, the hair on your head, every day. You don't see it growing. Until someone one day says, why don't you either get a violin or cut your hair? The growth is there. The growth is there. It's slow and it's imperceptible, as was for some of us our alcoholism. It was progressing, even though we couldn't see it. And so I suggest to you that in our practice of the spiritual steps of this program, there is progress. There is progress. Every single day, just as there is in our fingernails and in our hair. Sometimes we set for ourselves unreasonable and unrealistic goals. Self-destruction is really what it amounts to. Then we say, I ain't no good. Remember always that God sees us as we can be, but God loves us as we are. God loves us as we are. God does have expectations of us. He has expectations of us. Love one another as I have loved you. By this will men know that you are my disciples. That for me, as God, as I understand him, that's the criteria for me. We have to serve one another. And in doing that, we are, as I say, serving God. But it is difficult to every day to try to evaluate your whole life. So I'm going to make a suggestion to you. I suggest that maybe you don't want to do what I do. I try to pick out one dominant character defect in my life, or one virtue that I am totally lacking in, I'm trying to develop, and I work on that for today. For today, I'm not going to get angry. And consciously, I'm going to try and work at that. I'm going to be as conscious of that as possible and examine myself on that at the end of the day, rather than, as I say, trying to examine my whole life. And always we alkies look forward. We're always looking forward. When there is a need, often to look behind us. Success isn't how far you got. Measure your success by how far you have come. With God's grace. It certainly seems to me to be a kind of lack of gratitude on my part if I don't realize that there has been progress in my life. Again, humility is so essential to the spiritual life. But humility is truth. Humility is truth. It's not a case of beating our breasts and saying, I am no good. The spiritual life calls for us to do exactly the opposite. We are something marvelous. We are something wonderful. Sought through prayer and meditation, step 11, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer is an essential part of our spiritual life. I one time saw a bumper sticker. It said, you are a child of God. Call home. It's like the fellow who died and went to heaven, and he got a seat way in the back. He was a priest. Then there was another fellow who died and went to heaven, and he got a seat right up in the front. Well, the priest became indignant. He said, now wait a second, I've spent my whole life praying. He said, we used to pray at 4 o'clock in the morning. We used to pray again at 8 o'clock in the morning and at noon, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, in the evening. He said, we prayed around the clock. And the angel said to him, you made a pest of yourself. So I think that what we want to do, what might be a goal for us, is to make pests of ourselves as far as our relationship with God through the medium of prayer is concerned. Let's try and make a pest of ourselves. I doubt that we will, but we can try it. Chapter 5 of the big book says to us that God could and would heal us if he were sought. The 11th step tells us how to search for God and how to find God. We have to commit ourselves to prayer. We Alfies make lots of promises, you know, lots of promises. Losers make promises. Winners make commitments. And so there's a time in our lives when we have to commit ourselves to a prayerful life. And especially through meditation. Now, there are no two of us who are going to approach God exactly the same way. No two of us to approach God the same way. The only way that we can define prayer really is conversation with God. That's the best definition that I know of prayer, is conversation with God. And there can be no relationship, human or divine, without communication. None. None is possible. Meditation, I think it's misunderstood. It is difficult, there's no question about it, because we've got minds that are constantly running. It's very difficult to focus it in on one thing. But you know what we can do is we can pick up the big book and we can read a line from the big book, or we can pick up the scriptures and we can read a passage from the scripture, and then we simply sit and reflect upon, what is God saying to me? What is God saying to me? That's meditation. When we read the big book, or when we read the scriptures, or whatever pious material that we read, we should not read that in the sense that we would read a history book. We should pick up the big book and ask ourselves, what is God? What is God saying to me? Not what is he saying to all the drunks in the whole world, all the recovering alkies. No, no. What is God saying to me? God is going to speak to us through the big book. He speaks to us through the scriptures. And he speaks to us through people. So we have to, when we read the big book, ask ourselves, what is God saying to me? And then to reflect upon that. And to try to determine how to implement this particular thing in our lives, if it is not there. And if it is there, to praise God, thank God that this thing is in my life, is part of my life. That's what meditation is about. Prayer and meditation is not intended to change God. If you think you're going to change God's mind, you're wasting your time. The purpose of prayer and meditation is to change us. to bring us into conformity with God's will. And it's in, when we are in conformity with God's will, that we are happy, that we are happy. We were talking this morning, you know, when I was in treatment, I went through St. Vincent's Hospital in Cleveland. I forget now, it was about a 28-day program. The second day I was there, I had made up my mind, no more, this is it. You're not sending me any place after this. No, indeed. I was angry, and I was resentful. I went to the counselor about the second or third day, and I said, I'm telling you right now, I'm not going anywhere else. This is it. This is it. He said, what are you getting excited about? You know, you haven't even unpacked your bag yet. He said, and you're already telling us, you know, what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Well, I said, I'm telling you, this is it. Nothing more. See? I was unhappy. Unhappy. I was miserable for another week or 10 days until I finally made up my mind that if that's what God wants, I'll do it. Probably would have done it very reluctantly, but I'll do it. I'll do it. I knew a peace then that I had not experienced before. I think it was then that the program was able to work in my life. That is our purpose, to get into conformity with the will of God. And the will of God is revealed to us through prayer and meditation. It would be a cruel God that would will for us and then hide it and say, if you don't do my will, I'm going to get you. And that's the way some of us see God. We make a big thing out of determining what is God's will for us. What is God's will for us? God's will is not hidden. It's revealed to us through people, again through the scriptures, through the big book, through speakers at AA and so forth. God's will is not something that is hidden, like we hide Easter eggs from the children and then send them off to find them. No, God's will is revealed to us in our prayer and in our meditation. I remember saying to Father John, my sponsor, you know, I want to make a big thing about this, God's will. He said, I'll tell you what's God's will. You get up in the morning and you hit the floor and you ask God to keep you sober and you don't take a drink. Then he said, you take a shower and you get dressed and you don't take a drink. Now that was wise counsel, you see, because my Listerine bottle, as Father John knew, was filled with bourbon. See? That's how I got it together in the morning. I couldn't shave. At that time I used to shave. See? I couldn't shave. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't stop shaking and sweating. So I had to have it. You know, you talk about the dishonesty that we go through. I went to bed the night before saying to myself, high as a kite, tomorrow, no matter what happens, I'm not going to drink. No matter what happens, I'm going to sweat it out tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to sweat it out. And I didn't see the inconsistency there. Didn't see it at all. So I've already very carefully filled the Listerine bottle with a bourbon. But that's what he said to me. That's God's will. Then he said, you go and you eat your breakfast. After breakfast, he said, you don't take a drink. You go to work. Those of you who are married, you have responsibilities, and you know what those responsibilities are. As a wife, or as a husband, a father, or a mother. Carrying out those responsibilities. That's God's will for you. That's God's will for you. I know what is God's will for me. It's not always nice, not always comfortable to do what my local higher power tells me, but that's the way God's will is made known to me. So we don't have to go hunting for God's will. There are times in our lives when we come to a fork in the road. And then we have to pray and we have to seek counsel. There are few decisions you and I are going to be called upon to make that if we make the wrong decision, we're going to die as a result. When there's a doubt, you know, if you drink, you're going to die. So there's not a question there. But there are other things, other decisions that we have to make. And we may be uncertain about them. And so if we make the wrong decision, what do? You go back and do it the other way. It's not the end of the world. No one's going to cut off your hands or cut off your head, shoot you, put you to sleep, nothing like that at all. As far as prayer itself is concerned, you know, we have to be practical. There's a principle. Grace builds on nature. The supernatural builds on the natural. The natural means for the recovery from alcoholism, in my judgment, certainly for me, and I think for most people, is AA. That is a means that God has given. Now, a lot of us want to be exceptions to the rule, see? So we do like I did. We try controlled drinking. We try the medical doctor. We try the church. We try psychiatry. You know, try everything first. Looking for something special. Asking God to heal us in a unique way. We want a miracle in our lives. The ordinary means of recovery is through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. For me. The great dilemma in the last year, certainly, of my drinking was, why has God done this to me? With a generous heart, at 23 years of age, I gave myself to God. All right, I got in a little trouble later on. You know? Is that any reason to walk out on me? You know? Hell, and even in the human condition, wives stick with husbands through worse than what I was going through, or husbands with their wives. Why had God done this to me? Why would he not heal me through the church and through psychiatry and drugs, and abuse? Why? I couldn't understand it. I thought God had abandoned me. The reality was God had not abandoned me. I knew with absolute certainty that God willed my sobriety, but only through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. No other way. God was saying no to everything else. I thought he didn't hear my prayers. He heard them, but he said no. Got something better for you. Didn't seem to me to be better. So again, these are the ordinary means of bringing about God's will. And so there are ordinary things that we can do to improve our prayer life. We have to decide upon a time of day. If you're anything like me, you say, well, I haven't got time right now. I'll take time in the middle of the morning and sit by myself in the chapel. Well, something else happened. I'm going to do it after lunch, you know, and then after supper. And finally the day comes, you haven't done it. Haven't done it. So you have to, if you're going to become a prayerful person, you have to commit yourself to prayer. It has to have a priority in your life. I have to decide when I'm going to pray and where I'm going to pray and how long I'm going to do that. And I use all the means that are at my disposal to improve my prayer. If kneeling improves my prayer, I'm going to kneel. If sitting improves my prayer, I'm going to sit. There's a story told about a guy who used to just sit in church all day long, just stared at the altar. Someone was very edified and they said, "What do you talk about?" He said, "Nothing. I just look at him and he looks at me." That again is a prayer. If you have distractions in your prayer, as I have in mine, welcome to my world. That is part of the human condition. It's very difficult to talk to. Wouldn't you find it difficult to talk to me through a grill or through a door? When we don't see God face to face, it's difficult. Sure, that's part of the human condition. You have to accept that. That's the way it is. So there will be distractions in your life. Every time someone opens the door, all the eyes are going to turn towards the door. There are distractions. Don't worry about it. Doesn't mean your prayer is not good prayer. Console yourself with this. To try to pray is to pray. To try to pray is to pray. We're not praying when we just decide I don't have the time or it is not a priority in my life, so I don't have to do it right now. To try to pray is to pray. Prayer should become a habit, something we do every single day. But it should not become so routine that we can't say whether we have prayed today or not. We should bring to God our solutions, our problems rather, Bring to God our problems. Don't do like I did. I brought the solution. Say, that's a Freudian slip. God knows our needs. Now, some people say we shouldn't be asking God for things. I disagree with that. And again, I'm free to do that because I come to share with you my experience, my strength. I ask God for everything. Everything. Give me a safe trip home. And when I get home, I am aware of the fact that I got home only by the grace of God. I got here by the grace of God. And a little more than that, too. But like AA, the trip was worth it, let me tell you, you know. We want to bring to God our problems, not our solutions. Don't start explaining to God what is wrong with Aunt Sarah, you know. God already knows what's wrong with it. Just say, Aunt Sarah is sick, and I am concerned about that. Help her. And give me some peace, too. But don't specify how he should help her. Don't specify how. As I said to you, prayer, all of the spiritual life, is to change us, not to change God. Sometimes we go through things routinely, and not even aware of what we are about. Legalism, what I talked about briefly yesterday. We go through the motions and we figure that's it. How about the guy who went to confession? And he confessed to the priest that he had stolen some lumber. And the priest admonished him. He said, you know, don't do that. Don't do that again. He gave him a penance and then he gave him absolution, sent him on his way. The guy is back next week. Same thing. He had stolen some lumber. The priest said, well, you know, you got to stop that. Just continue. He said, you know, you got to change. But God forgives you. He gave him absolution. He sent him on his way. The guy is back the following week. The same thing. He stole lumber. And the priest said, now listen. He said, you have to change. You just can't keep coming back with the same thing again and again and again. You know, you have to change. You can't keep doing these things. He said, son, he said, do you know how to make a novena? And the guy said, I don't, Father. He said, but if you can get the plans, I know where we can get the lumber. And sometimes that's the way we are. We become very legalistic. We go, you know, we get down on our knees, whatever it is, and at the end of the day, you can't say whether you prayed or not. Just don't remember. It's become so routine. I personally don't believe in such terms as the guy upstairs. You know, we are talking about the Lord God Almighty, who always was, who is, and who always will be. Respect, reverence for God is important. Our prayer should include adoration of God. We should again and again tell God that we're sorry for the past. Don't grieve over it. And when we have done something wrong, we tell God that we're sorry. We thank him for all the blessings that have come into our lives, which are so many, especially you and I who have been blessed by this fellowship. And then ask God for what you need. God, as I understand him, told me that. Ask and you shall receive, that your joy may be full. Ask him. Ask him. God's answer to our prayers is always far wiser than our prayers. Remember that. There are three answers to prayers. Yes, no, and not now. How grateful I am that God did not grant me my prayer when I knelt down and took the pledge. As I say, those deeper underlying problems would probably still be dominating my life if that had been the case. Instead, he said, no, AA, here's a gift. And here, I was healed. You know, one of the marvelous things, as I say to you about Bill Wilson and how this program is inspired, today the big thing is holistic medicine, you know? Someone has cancer, you just don't treat the cancer. No, indeed, you have to treat the psyche, you know, explain to them. Help the whole person. Help heal the whole person. Hell, AA has been doing that for 49 years. It's the only that treated the total person, mental, spiritual, and physical. You're going to tell me that Bill Wilson was not gifted by God in the spirit? He didn't even realize that he was practicing holistic medicine treatment. As I said to you before, God gives the very best to those who leave the choice to Him. Bring to God our problems and not the solutions. I used to deal with God like He was a used car salesman. Get the most out of Him for the least. I one time said that, and it turned out to be a used car salesman in the group who took offense to it. So if you're a used car salesman, I'm talking about used car salesmen in general. Yeah, that was my striking up bargains with God. Striking up bargains with God. God is Santa Claus. Someone has already mentioned that. We pray, and God answers our prayer. But not the way we expected it. So you say, hey, reach in the bag again. See what else is in there, you know. Don't want that. That's the way we can be. That's the way we can be. There's a little prayer which I'd like to share with you. It's called Win by Losing. I think probably many of you have heard it already. I prayed to God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I prayed for health that I might do great things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I prayed for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I prayed for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of good. I prayed for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I prayed for, but everything I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. I among all men are most richly blessed. God answers all prayer. I know that from my own experience, but not always the way that I want it. I think that it's in our prayer life, for me particularly, it was a hard lesson to learn. We Catholics are given to going into church or getting into a position of prayer and talking at God and then leaving. I don't know when He's supposed to talk to us, you see, unless He trips you on the way out. We have to listen. In all of our prayers, there has to be a time of quiet to allow God to speak to us. I one time was extremely distressed about the situation, and I really didn't know what was the matter. And I went into the chapel, not because of the chapel per se, but it was the quietest place in the house. And I didn't say, I just sat there. And it came to me. The quotation came right out of the clear blue sky. Why do you worry? I take care of the birds of the air. I'll take care of you. And that was what my problem was. I was worrying. I was playing God. Worry is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but it gets you nowhere. It is the biggest waste of time. It is like shoveling smoke, if you will. Or jumping on a wooden horse to make a fast getaway. Yeah. Biggest waste of time. I know that in my heart. But I sometimes do it, and you do it sometimes subconsciously. But it was only through prayer that God was able to say to me, you know, stop worrying. I'm here. I'm not asleep. I think God wearies of listening. We can't tell Him anything He doesn't already know. So we should try to listen. As a Catholic, I never thought I'd be quoting Martin Luther. But it's a new day in our church, huh? I need all the help I can get, personally. Luther once said, fewer the words, better the prayer. The one thing that I think we have to be very careful of is never yield to despair or never yield to discouragement. I personally believe in a devil. That's my personal belief. However, the devil is not near as active as people would have him believe. My own body, the world around me, the people around me, many of them do the work of the devil as far as that's concerned, you know. Tempting me to things that are contrary to my beliefs and so forth. But there is one area in which the devil is active, and that is discouragement. Did you ever see somebody trying to get back again after a slip? The man who was leading the first meeting I went to when I came out of treatment, he was sober for 3 years at that time. He remained sober for another 2 years and got drunk. And he was drunk for many years afterwards. He's sober again now, thanks be to God. But the only reason for that man was more knowledgeable about alcoholism than I'll ever be. The only reason was discouragement. And so in our spiritual life, even though, another thing is, you and I are always comparing ourselves to the one next to us. How come I ain't as serene as she is? You know, I always do that. How come I'm not as spiritual as he is? We always, it's programmed, we come out on the short end of the stick. Always. So we do, that's another thing that we'd want to do. We'd want to become discouraged, and we don't want to compare ourselves to others. Just remember that the greatest saints are simply sinners who just kept on trying. On the subject of church, we go to the big book. And in the big book, in chapter 2, it says that most of us favor membership in a religious body. I suggest that to you as part of your spiritual program. How will you come to understand God if you don't pursue him with people who have some expertise in this area? I think it complements. Never, for God's sake, am I suggesting a replacement. You know, my sponsor said to me, the three things I give you to do: don't take that first drink, go to AA, and pray. No substitutions, like it says on the menu in Denny's. No substitution. You do not substitute church for AA. No, indeed. He told me about a guy who went through the treatment facility just before me. He was president of his own company. And after having gone through the treatment, and he got the same advice that I got, he went home. But he said, he explained to Father John, he found out, he said, that while he was in the hospital, his business had deteriorated. Hell, he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. He'd been drinking, you know, like for 10 years or something. It had deteriorated while he was drinking, not while he was in the hospital. And so he was going to modify John's counsel. And since he couldn't go to meetings because he had to do his work, he substituted church. And he went to Mass every day, went to the 6:30 Mass every morning. And after about a month, he got drunk. He came back to Father John, he asked him, he said, where did I go wrong? John said, look, you want to be a priest? Go to Mass every day. You want to be a Monsignor, he said, get yourself a collection basket and go to Mass every day. You want to get sober, you go to AA. So, I'm not suggesting church as a substitute, but it is something that will help us. It complements our sobriety. We want to listen to God with both ears, not just with our AA ear. God wants to speak to us through our church, whatever a church that may be. We should always remember, too, that if you pray, you know, why worry? And if you worry, why bother to pray? I think what I'd like to do now is to take that break. It's for about 15 minutes. George. Well, Father talked to George again and again and again, but made no impression on him at all. So no impression on him at all. But he was always trying to get him to stop drinking and, you know, straighten himself up. But George never got the message. Well, one day, Father saw George coming down the road, and he was weaving from side to side. And of course, you know, first thing, he made a beeline for the collar, and he said, "Father, can I talk to you?" And the priest said, "Sure, be delighted." He said, "Father, tell me," he said, "what causes shingles?" And the priest thought, "Ah, here's a chance. What causes shingles, George?" He said, "I'll tell you what causes shingles. Drinking. Drinking causes shingles. Drinking, sexual excesses, raising, running around, doing nothing, that's what causes shingles. Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, I just read in the paper that the bishop has got a bad case of shingles." So don't lie to alkies. Tell us just the way it is. That's, you know, just the way it is. That's like playing God. You figure to take advantage of the situation, you know. Play God. No, you just tell them the way it is. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Dr. Harris, in his book, I'm Okay, You're Okay, says, "We may not understand religious experience. We may differ in explanation, but we cannot, if we are honest, deny the reports of such experiences by reputable men through the ages." I told you yesterday what my understanding of the spiritual awakening is. That is when we come to the realization we are not God. God is working in our lives. God is there, involved in every single area of my life, concerned about me, loving me, willing. God wills our happiness. God wills our happiness. Another thing I want to get clear is I don't believe, I don't know any priest that I know of that believes God never tempts us. God is never testing us. When we think that we have troubles that are overwhelming us, and maybe God is testing us, God is not testing us. You turn around, you'll find some human being pretty close by who's the cause of all your troubles. Or yourself. But God is no tempter or tester. God wills our happiness. God wills our, God, as I understand him, is my friend. And I have to, the spiritual awakening for me came when I came to that realization. And the second part is when I come to the realization that I am something marvelous, something precious, that I am in fact God's spoken word. God called us into existence. He loves us. God never changes. If God has ever loved us, he has always loved us. But I am something wonderful. I am, Cardinal Newman says, as essential to God's plan as the archangels. No less. We have to grow, I think. I know I have to grow in the awareness of these two conditions. God in my life and the fact that I am something precious. When these two things coexist, the spiritual awakening happens. It's the beginning. It's not the end. I haven't arrived, done the 12 steps, and now I've had my spiritual awakening. No, it is simply the beginning. We can grow in the love of God, and we must grow in the love of ourselves. We love ourselves first before or one another. If I do not love myself, then what is the value of the gift of my love to you? If it doesn't, what is the value of it to an old, worn-out overcoat that you would give to Goodwill, but instead someone else comes to the door and you give it to him? That's no great sacrifice. What does it doesn't mean anything to you? You're going to throw it out or give it to Goodwill. No, we have to love ourselves. See, the marvelous creature that we are, not of our own, but from God. And we be very careful with the gift of our love. Be prudent with whom we give it. We give it in varying degrees. Be careful when you give the total self, that very precious gift of yourself, to another human being. Give it to God. As I said to you yesterday, Genesis ends with the words, having looked upon all that he created, God said, it is very good. Not just it is good, it is very good. And you and I spend so much of our adult lives disputing with God. He or she, great. Not me, if you knew me. Someone else mentioned it, I think, last night at the meeting here, but there is a wealth of theology. You are a theologian if you can accept the fact that God does not create junk. God does not create junk. Groucho Marx once said that he would never join any organization that would have him for a member. You know? And I think a lot of us feel that way about us. We get into a group, geez, aren't we lucky? They accepted us. My attitude since I came to AA is, aren't they lucky I joined them? You know, not AA, but other groups. You know? Because AA gets all my attention outside of my attention that I have to give to my vocation, to my religious community. I've said to you again and again, grace builds on nature, the supernatural on the natural. We don't go looking for miracles, looking to God for miracles day in and day out. God has provided ordinary means for us to grow. For us, the ordinary means is AA for our recovery. And there are ordinary means too. Psychology, for example. Come to understand ourselves. Use those things. Use those things that we can. A definition here. An individual's self-concept is the core of his or her personality. It affects every aspect of human behavior. The ability to learn, the capacity to grow and to change, the choice of friends, mates, and careers. It is no exaggeration to say that a strong, positive self-image is the best possible preparation for success in life. That's a very secular approach to it. But there's a wealth of truth in there. A wealth of truth in there. I mean, God made all things, even the psychologists. God has revealed these things. So we want to be aware of that. We want to be aware of that. The definition, really, of self-esteem, the total perception that one has of him or herself, their intrinsic worth. And we know the problem that Bill Wilson had with that. You know, why do we feel the way we feel about ourselves? I don't know. That came up again at a meeting last night. When I was in treatment, I went to Father John. I said, John, why do you think I drank? Why do you think I drank? I was hoping he'd say, you know, give me some explanation. It certainly wasn't me. Huh? He said, listen, when you find a man on the back of a Bengal tiger, he's holding on for dear life, but he's losing his grip, and he knows that when he falls off, he's going to get eaten by that tiger. He said, you don't ask him, how'd you get there? You do what you can to help him. He said, you're drinking? Supposing, he said, I told you it was because your mother wore army shoes in the kitchen. Or she wore polka dot bloomers. That's exactly what he said to me. He said, is that going to give you the ability to drink safely now, socially? let's not, he said, dig for things like that. Rather, accept the situation as it is and do something about it. Get on with living. That's what it is. That's what it is. You know? But why do we have this low self-esteem? Why do we question our masculinity? Maybe when you were a kid, somebody said, those are sissy shoes. And that has stayed with us for years. Maybe in grade school, they put the dunce cap on you. And that impression has never left you. Or your mother said, how come you ain't as smart as your brother? He gets A's. You always come home with C's. I heard a guy one time in Silver Spring say, I could figure out why he had low self-esteem. In his drinking days, he bought himself a hat. He paid $40 for the hat, and he came home and he showed it to his mother. And she said, I'll be damned. A $40 hat on a 10-cent head. But why do we feel the way we feel? I don't know. And it really isn't important. It really isn't important. Accept what I am saying to you. You are as precious to God and to His plans as the archangels. You are something wonderful. You are something marvelous. You know, in the story of the Wizard of Oz, there is a wealth of knowledge, let's say, to draw from that story. The straw man, he wanted a brain. The tin man, he wanted a heart. And the lion, he wanted courage. They went to see the wizard. Those of you who are familiar with the story, the wizard didn't do anything for them. He gave one guy a diploma. Said, you are now brilliant. He gave the tin man a plastic heart with a watch, ticked. Said, here, there's your heart. And the lion, he gave him a medal. What he did, in effect, was to draw out of those individuals the great gifts that were there all along, had always been there. The lion was courageous. Why he felt he wasn't, I don't know. The tin man, he had a heart, he had feelings. Relationship with Dorothy, huh? And the straw man, he had intelligence, just had to be drawn out of it. And you and I are much that way. We're always putting ourselves down. Don't do that to yourself. There's a story told about Michelangelo, who one day went to a quarry in Rome, and he got this enormous piece of marble, which he had delivered to his studio. And he just put it in the studio, and he stared at it. He studied it. And then one day he got up with a chisel and a hammer, and he chiseled away what he regarded as excess, as unnecessary. And when he was finished, what he had was the statue of David. My brothers and sisters, in each of us is a David. We got to just get rid of the trash, get rid of the junk. How we accumulated it, I really don't think that it's important. That's not important. Let's just do something about it. In the final analysis, I believe that I will be judged not on how often I went to a church or how generous I was with the church or anything of that nature at all. In the end, we will be judged by love, solely by love. God, as I understand Him, which is I am sharing with you, said that in the end, you will be judged by love. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was naked and you covered me. In prison and in hospitals and you ministered to me. See, one of the great debts that I owe to AA is that I have been given a unique ability. The world is filled with people who hunger for sobriety, who thirst for serenity, who have been stripped naked of their human dignity through this disease of alcoholism. They're in hospitals and they're in jails. And I have a unique gift from God, which I recognize it is from God, to minister to those people. And I believe that in the end, God will say to me, Alexis, I hungered for sobriety, and you brought it to me. I was thirsting for serenity, you led the way. You ministered to me in hospitals and in jail. That's a great gift that God has given to me. It's my alcoholism. God turned it around. Turned it around and made it a great gift. In this 12th step, we talk about carrying the message to other alcoholics. Not all of us do it the same way. Again, I believe that making coffee and setting up the chairs, all that is all 12-step work. It's what makes this program possible, makes it possible for us. It is as St. Paul says, we have different gifts. All of us have been given, none greater than the other, different, that's all, just different. That's different. So don't worry if you're not on 12-step calls every day of the week. There are other things that are necessary for our fellowship to go on. Many other things. Meetings. Our presence at meetings. I remember one time when I first came into the program, I said something about it. I didn't think I needed a meeting. And this guy said, well, maybe you don't need one, but you might be needed at the meeting. Someone there might need you. Thank God there was someone in that room when I went to that first meeting in Langley Park. Everyone there, you know, made up that group. Thank God. They did, in a certain sense, 12-step me that night. So that's why we should go to the meetings. Another thing, I think that we want to be confident of our sobriety. Oh, for God's sake, nothing drives me crazier than people saying, I am one drink away from drunk. Maybe that's true in a certain sense. But God did not rescue us drowning in the Atlantic Ocean, you know, to now drown us on the shore. We want to have confidence in our sobriety. We have the book that tells us, if you do these things, you're going to be sober and you're going to be serene. We've turned ourselves over to God. We want to be confident in it, comfortable, not complacent. I'm not going to drink today with God's help, you know. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to worry about it. God wills that I be serene. If you want to see whether you are complacent or simply have confidence in God, that's a virtue, to have confidence in God. Take God at His word. Take God at His word. It's in the book, in the big book. And when you follow that reasoning through that I gave you, that God inspired this, this is what God is saying to me, Alexis, you'll stay sober. I have confidence in God. I believe Him. But if you want to determine whether or not you have confidence in God or you are complacent, I suggest to you your attitude towards new people. That's the key. That's the key. If you can remain compassionate and understanding, if you can empathize, if you're always willing to go and to help, that tells me that you are confident of your sobriety. If you adopt an attitude, if I adopt an attitude of, I got it the hard way, you're going to have to get it the hard way, see? That's complacency as far as I'm concerned. You know, as someone said, you may be the only copy of the big book that that drunk is going to read or ever see. And so we want to avoid complacency. But we want to have confidence in God. Walk with our head held high. God has told us it's going to be okay. We're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. When we work with others, we shouldn't measure how much we have given, but rather what, with God's help, how much we have left. Every time we give something in this program, it seems to me, we get it back. There is another dimension, another virtue, which is, in my judgment, essential to our spiritual life. You know, the first word of the steps says we. I have to share with you. I wasn't too impressed by that when I first came. See, I went to see a shrink. And he said to me, I was as honest with that man as I've been with anybody. And he said to me, we, I like that, say that, I'm not going to do it alone. We are about to start upon a new way of life. I want to emphasize here again, I'm not knocking psychiatry. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. Hey, we are about to start upon a new way of life. Very good. But he said to me, you are a little nervous. And so I'm going to give you something. It'll calm you down, he said, and then we'll talk. Well, he gave me something. And in about 10 minutes, that new way of life arrived. And I thought, I can live with this. Well, I felt so good about this. On the way home, I stopped and had a couple of drinks. Okay. Before, my blackouts used to last 3-4 hours, you know, or I'd go to bed or something, or sometimes I'd slip in and out of these things, but 3 or 4 hours. Now they lasted 2 days. So, as I say, I just was not overly impressed by we. But the first word in the steps is we. And that's important. It should cause us to be grateful. Grateful. Gratitude for favors received, more than anything else, touches the heart of God. We must remain grateful men and women. The terrible danger is if we do not remain grateful, we may one day come to the conclusion that I have done this. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. I made a decision. And then I'm in trouble. As I said to you, the same thing regarding our prayers. Ask God for whatever you want. Be willing to accept whatever He gives you. But ask Him. And know that it comes from God. Every good gift, every perfect gift, comes from above. That's very, very important, that we always remain grateful. In our own lives, on the level of the human, how outraged we become at a lack of gratitude. We must remain grateful men and women. And the virtue of gratitude, I suggest to you, is the guardian, the sentinel of our sobriety. We cannot be serenely sober, I don't believe, without a genuine sense of gratitude. And it is the old-timers in this program, people like Phil back here, who are always talking about gratitude. Sometimes you figure, got enough of it. Yeah. But it is the key. It is the key. It is the guardian. I believe, and again I share with you, God as I understand Him, He not only appreciates gratitude, He demands it. At one time He cured 10 lepers. They said, we, Lord, cleanse us, cleanse us. He said, go. And they went. And as they went, they found they were cured, cleansed of their leprosy. One of them came back to give thanks. And his response was, were not 10 made clean? Where are the other 9? So gratitude is not just something that we do because we're nice people. No, it is essential. It is essential in my judgment, to my sobriety, absolutely essential to my sobriety. If I take credit for my sobriety, I'm a fool, and I'm going to have it very long. Ben Franklin once said, God does the healing, and the doctor gets the fee. We have to see that it is God that is doing these things for us. Through instruments, treatment facilities, and through doctors, and through AA. And for some of us, when we first come to the program, the group is our higher power. Ultimately, with God's help, we see beyond the group. It is God working through the group. At DePaul Hospital, I think it's in Richmond, the sisters have a logo on their letterhead, and it says, we dress the wound, and God heals it. And that's what we have to realize, that having done everything we can, we have not gotten ourselves sober. We have done what we can do, and God has done for us what we have not been able to do for ourselves. I suggest to you that that sobriety is like a castle, and the steps are the stones with which we build that castle, but gratitude is the mortar that holds it together. It's also been my experience that when we work with other alcoholics, when we work with people, we are really filled with gratitude. We become very grateful people because we see people get well. And we know that we don't have any strange power. As I think I already said to you, I don't take credit for anybody's getting sober, nor do I take the blame for anybody getting drunk. It is God. We are simply instruments in the hands of God. And working with people does help us to grow in gratitude. However, my sponsor told me, and I share with you, he said it is not enough to get up and say, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Talk is cheap. You got to put your money where your mouth is. You got to express that gratitude in prayer every day, every day. And you got to do what you can for the group, whatever group you belong to. There are those, someone once said, there are those who give and forget. Unfortunately, he said, there are also those who get and forget. One of the greatest aids, as I say, to serenity is gratitude. And so, to God as we understand, however we perceive Him, who has given us so much, our sobriety, this fellowship, Al-Anon, to God who has given us so much, we should ask Him for one thing more, and that is for a grateful heart. And on the subject of gratitude, Bill Wilson wrote in The Grapevine in 1962. He says, one exercise that I practice is to try for a full inventory of my blessings, and then for a right acceptance of the many gifts that are mine, both temporal and spiritual. Here I try to achieve a state of joyful gratitude. When such a brand of gratitude is repeatedly affirmed and pondered, it can finally displace the natural tendency to congratulate myself on whatever progress I may have been enabled to make in some areas of my living. I try hard to hold fast to the truth that a full and thankful heart cannot entertain great deceits. When brimming with gratitude, one's heartbeat must surely result in outgoing love, the finest emotion that we can know. The finest emotion that we can know is gratitude. And we have that again from the co-founder of our fellowship. I think another thing is we always have to be constantly reminded of the fact that we have a fatal disease. Constantly reminded. We have to be constantly reminded that we were spared the natural results of this disease. That's a marvelous thing when you think of how many alcoholics are out there dying. You know, if you have any doubt that alcoholism is a fatal disease, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, a psychiatrist of note, and her book on death and dying, she made a study of people who are terminally ill, a study that covered several years, I think thousands of people. And she says that when one is confronted with a terminal illness, there are five stages that you pass through. She said the very first stage is denial. No, must be some mistake. Must be some mistake. That doctor, he's not too smart, you know. Or maybe they got the x-rays mixed up. Doctor told you got cancer. Now, it must be something wrong. Can't be. Absolute denial. Go to another doctor. Try something else. She says the second stage is rage and anger. Why me? Why me? Why me? Why does this have to happen to me? She said, the third stage is bargaining. If you will spare me, Lord, I will not only go to church on Sundays, how about Wednesdays too? And I will do this, and I will do that. And when God doesn't change things, then one slips into a depression. She said, that is the fourth stage, depression. The fifth stage, she says, is acceptance. Acceptance of the fact that I am going to die. Now, what alcoholic out there will deny that he or she has not passed through those five stages? But for us, God did not ask our lives. He simply asked us to accept sobriety, accept AA. So we have much, much to be grateful for. As I say, we often say, it is a fatal disease. But I wonder if we fully realize just how fatal. I think it's important to understand to the best degree that we can every aspect of our illness. And Kubler-Ross's studies contribute to our acceptance of the fact that what we have is a fatal disease. I would like to speak on the subject of sponsorship and surrender. There's so many things, but just time doesn't allow. But I think I'd be a little bit remiss if I didn't speak, even though it may not be directly related to the spiritual part of the program, though it is part of it, no question about it, but directly, you might have to strain a little bit to get it tied together. And that's the subject of AA meetings. As I said, I think that we should try to understand on the natural level, as much as we can about our disease, as much as we can about our recovery. We should go to church to learn about God, to come to a greater understanding of God. But there are people who go to the church, they don't know why they go to church. Some kind of magic, something happens. Or maybe they just touch base. We've been around the program and we hear people say, if you don't go to meetings, you get drunk. Yeah? If you don't understand that, it seems to me, that is superstition. Superstition. Personally, I don't see any magic in 90 meetings in 90 days. You can become very legalistic. No magic in it, unless you know what it is you are about. I suggest the meetings are our life support system. That's what it amounts to. It's our life support system. There is a spiritual dimension to the meetings in that we go to them, as I said, we go to them with an attitude that I am an instrument in the hands of God. Put me in touch with someone at that meeting, someone I might be able to help. We all admire happy sobriety. My God, if you can't do anything else, go to the meeting smiling. You know, be happy. When anyone says to me, how you doing? I say, if it gets any better, I'm going to OD. I hope someone says, I want to be like that. I want to get some of that. See? So that's the dimension, the spiritual dimension, if you will, in going to the meetings. But in the practical sense, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. We go to meetings to remember the reality of our drinking. There are two purposes, if you will. One is to give thanks to God for what, with His help, we have become. But secondly, to remember what we are. You know, we do everything possible. I was reminded of this morning at breakfast. We do everything possible to preserve the happy moments in our lives. You get married, hell, you spend $1,000 taking pictures, having little match covers made up, You know, Jack and Mary, Jack and Jill, and the date. See? Everything, little swizzle sticks, the little bell on it, and the names. Trying to capture and preserve that happy memory. And those happy memories that we're so anxious to hold on to, they fade with the passage of time. They fade. We can't even remember who was at the reception. And we're sober, I mean, you know. God has built into each of us a forgetter. And it's a marvelous thing. It's a marvelous thing. It's a gift. It's a gift. You see, if you or I could recall every tragedy in our lives at once, we would die. We have all experienced great tragedies. The death of a spouse, the death of a child, of a parent. And when we go through that, we say to ourselves, I'll never get over this. I'll never get over it. You will. You will. A day will come when you won't think about that tragedy for a whole day. Maybe for a week. That's God's goodness. And it's a marvelous thing. The healing of memory is a marvelous thing. Except for those of us that are alkies. The minute we forget the reality, we are in difficulty. We are in trouble. I go to meetings to remember. That's why I speak. To remember the reality of my drinking. Left to my own devices, I could believe that my drinking was a Manhattan. After the midnight mass, nothing bad happened. I had a Manhattan, I felt a nice warm glow. That's not the reality of my drinking. The reality of my drinking is coming up New Hampshire Avenue in Silver Spring on all fours, 3 o'clock in the morning, I can't even stand up, I've lost the automobile. You know? A taxi driver makes a U-turn and he picks me up and he takes me home. I like to add that he was a little bit surprised at where I lived. That's the reality of my drinking. And I go to meetings to keep that alive. And I share when I speak or on a one-to-one to keep that memory alive so that I will, with God's help, never put AA, never put my recovery, my sobriety, into second place. Try though I may, things slip away from me. One day, I was helping with communions in the parish church, and suddenly standing in front of me was the doctor who took care of me when I attempted suicide. You wouldn't believe what I experienced that moment. My hands began to shake. All the fear came back. I remembered details of that incident that I had long ago, I thought, forgotten, never even thought about. That was a vivid reminder. Maybe God sent it into my life for a reason. I don't know. But it brought back a great many memories. And that's why I have to go to the meetings. And let us, you and I, be the men and women that God wants us to be. Loving people. Never, I exhort you, tell someone to take the cotton out of their ears and stick it in their mouth. Or to keep it simple, stupid. That person to whom you are speaking is made to the image and likeness of God. They deserve more. No matter how drunk they are, they deserve more consideration, more kindness. Let's be faulted for our kindness and not for having turned people off by things that we might say. At a meeting, someone who was new, they can be a pain in the neck. I know that. And you don't let them take over the meeting. I know that too. But it may be the first time that anyone has listened to them. First time they've been able to talk about their problems, you know. Let them talk. Let them see the beautiful side of our program, the beautiful people in our program. There's a line in a hit song that the Pips, Gladys Knight and the Pips had. Barbara Streisand did it too. The way we were. It's the laughter we'll remember whenever we remember the way we were. Things too painful to remember, we simply chose to forget. Has time rewritten every line? Yeah. That's why we go to the meetings, to to keep remembering, to struggle against, too perfect a healing in our memories. Again, and more on the spiritual aspect of it. The message that you and I carry is God's message. It is a beautiful message, and it should be carried in vessels of gold and silver, not in garbage cans. The podium is no place for us to dump our garbage. No place at all. Father John one time said to me, again, in keeping with this thing about a good cook, a cook's by the book. You do it the way the book says. He said, some people will say, every time I get up, I do part of my fifth step. You know? Every time I get up, I do part of my fifth step. Well, he said, listen, in the course of our lifetime, all of us need an enema. But he said, we don't take it in the parlor. The book tells us how we ought to do that. The book also says our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. Gossip is another great tragedy in our fellowship. Thank God it's very little of it, but let it never be you or me that is responsible for it. I went to a funeral of a fellow I sponsored. It's funny, you know. This guy dropped dead while he was speaking. And I asked someone, I said, where was Ed in his story? And they told me, and I knew just where he was when he dropped dead. But one of the most beautiful things was, you know, at the funeral, you never say anything bad about the dead. I realize that. But this was not just not saying anything bad about the dead. Everyone had something good to say about Ed, the fact that he said you never heard Ed talk about anybody except to say something good about them. And I think that's something that I would like to aspire to. I'd like them to say, you know, that Alexis, he wasn't very smart at times, you know, but he never said anything bad about anybody. Never said anything bad about. And gossip is a very divisive thing to our fellowship. And one of our goals, huh, is unity. Unity. One of our legacies, unity. It's now 10:45, and I'm going to leave those 15 minutes for anyone that might want to ask a question about what I have talked about. I would just like to close with this very brief quotation again from the big book. And before I leave, I want to tell you that I genuinely appreciate being asked to come here and to share my experience, my strength, and my hope with you. And I'm very touched by the attention that you have given me. You know, I thought I was the only one that was hypnotized by the sound of my own voice. But you have been very, very kind. When I first came into the program, Father John said to me, every night, he said, you must thank God for that day of sobriety. And then you must ask him to keep you sober the next day. And I've done that. But I wasn't in the program a week when I began. I felt a very strong debt towards that woman in Al-Anon. But I began immediately to pray for everyone who was in AA, for everyone who was in Al-Anon and Alateen, and for our brothers and sisters who are out there still suffering. So I've been praying for you for 10 years now. And so from now on, when you speak to God as you understand him, say a prayer for little old Alexis, all right? And I'd like to close with this, again from page 85 of the big book. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Love you all. Thank you, and God bless you. Now, if anybody had any questions they'd like to ask. Thank you.